Welcome to another episode of Salesforce Trails and Trials, where we help you accelerate your career and turn soft skills into hard money by mining gold from project failures, bringing insights from ecosystem experts, and inspiration from others on the trail. Now joining us with over 20 years in the ecosystem, please welcome our host, John Klein.
Welcome, everyone. This is a new episode of Salesforce Trails and Trials, and we are glad to be with you. I'm John Klein, and today with me, I have Jackson Hull, who is with DevPod for Salesforce Partners. And why don't you tell us a little bit about what DevPod does and what's your role?
Yeah, so glad to be here. And DevPod is designed to partner with Salesforce implementation partners, and our goal is to reduce the risk of SIs and to increase and unlock opportunities. So we specifically want to partner with SIs to grow their team's ability to connect with clients and specifically to mitigate risk by implementing our people first method.
Cool. And what's your role there?
I'm a business analyst. So I've been working with DevPod for about 4 years, specifically on the business analyst side.
All right, cool. So exciting day today. I'll actually share it on the screen for the people who are watching on Zoom. There's an article came out from Salesforce Ben, and really just trying to help partners make better decisions about what partners they work with. Essentially, this was a response to another article, which I'll show here, called Does Salesforce Have an Issue with Bad Consultancy Partners? We'll have links to both of these in the show notes for those just listening. And this was written back in November. And I read this. I thought it was a great article. I actually know several of the people that were interviewed for the article. And the concern I had is that, one, it's realistic. There are a lot of project failures that are not known about, and it's not something that people like to chat about. I mean, when's the last time someone came up to you and said, dude, I was part of this project failure, let me tell you about it? Probably not going to happen, but there's a lot of gold to be mined from that and a lot of learning that's really important. And so I felt it was really critical to provide some action step, some way for a partner to move forward in figuring out, well, there's a lot of bad partners. Is it just random? Do I just have to... like, what should I trust? Should I trust the AppExchange listing? Should I trust peer reviews? Should I only work with people who I know others who have worked with them? That can be a difficult proposition. So we're going to talk a little bit about this article and just kind of go into some additional examples today as we look to kind of maximize the really the potential of what this article could mean for people who are looking to choose a Salesforce partner. And I think, as Jackson mentioned, DevPod for Salesforce Partners is essentially a kind of subcontracting partner behind many other SIs looking to deliver great projects and add residual benefit and on-demand talent for their teams. Also, anybody who's choosing a partner. So it's very common, actually, for partners to get other partners to help. Salesforce uses these kind of partner teams for building out significant Dreamforce projects that they want to demonstrate. And this is for partners choosing partners. It's for customers choosing partners, trying to find out how do they know, at least how can they have a higher likelihood that a partner is going to actually deliver on what they say. So let's talk through an example here. First off, I highlight in the article a little bit of research from, you know, a gentleman named Steve Andreoli, and he highlights, for example, that he sees, you know, 75% of ERP projects fail from Gartner. He also sees that another gentleman, Clayton Christensen, who's another researcher, he suggests that 95% of product innovation projects fail. Now, certainly these are wider than just the Salesforce ecosystem, but Salesforce is just inheriting a lot of the challenges, expectations, and other elements from the wider world. And so this data on technical projects in general is really relevant. Did you ever think that failure rates for a project of technical project could ever be like 75% or 95%?
Yes, it seems hard to believe that it's that high for project failure. And what's even worse is that they also mention that one of the more difficult findings is not only do the projects fail, but they're actually failing to deliver any measurable ROI. which is even more difficult to believe because you'd think at least the 25, 10, 5% of projects that are succeeding are at least providing value or at least providing measurable ROI. But unfortunately, the articles that you mentioned are finding 90% aren't providing that measurable ROI.
Yeah, when I saw those numbers, I was just, wow, that just seems so high. And you know what's funny is I actually didn't believe it when I first saw it. And so I went through an exercise that actually I wanted to learn another product. You guys may have heard of a product called Notebook LM. It's a little research product put out by Google where you can create your own little learning model of data. You can have up to 50 sources of like web pages or PDFs or YouTube, even audio files, and you can drop them in there. So I started doing my own research and looking for just data on project failures. So I found it was kind of tough to find because, as I mentioned, like not a lot of people want to talk about it. It's not something you put on your resume, you're not going to put it on your website. So tracking it down was a little tough. But I ended up finding several resources that had over 10,000 projects as part of their research sample. And then a lot of individual case studies like the Foxmire drugs that we've talked about before. And there's many more actually in the works on the Tales from the Fails side coming soon. But I was really surprised. And so I put all those into Notebook LM, and come to find out, these numbers are actually fairly well represented. Certainly, 95% is a little more rare and tends to focus on the bigger projects. So, the larger your project is, the more likely it is to fail. So, I'd say one takeaway from this is if there's one thing you can do, no matter who you work with, to help bring your project a higher likelihood of success, make it smaller. Because if the people working on the project can't really comprehend the landscape of what is needed, and the people working in the business who are responsible for defining the requirements and kind of the target can't fully comprehend the full scope of the project and its benefits, they can't articulate what the target should look like. And now, if no one knows about the clear target that everybody's going for, how is anybody going to hit it? I mean, I guess what is there that phrase that says, if you don't know what you want, I guess you always get it. I was really doubtful. So now I have over 30 sources, some of which contain over 10,000 projects in that sample size. And these numbers have been very well supported.
That's great. Yeah, I want to jump back real quick to something you said. At DevPod, we really emphasize two things. One, the continuous deployment, which is kind of something that you were mentioning there, that we shouldn't be focused on bringing a massive amount of metadata or moving a ton of configuration all at once over a year's worth of work, because that is providing a greater surface area of failure. But if we're breaking up projects not only into smaller teams, but into smaller deployments, wherein we change one configuration or one process, we focus on that and then move it over, we see our success skyrocket and adoption also skyrockets because the dopamine that we're providing for our team, for the client's team, for the partner's team is increasing because we're always providing successful deployments, always providing value, and we're giving the users something that they can adopt and not shuttling in massive amounts of change all at once. And so that's something that we've seen success in too, is not only making the team smaller, but making what you change more frequent, but also smaller.
Yeah, great. Great example. So let's go and move on to our first question here and talk a little bit about that. So the first question from the article is, how do you coach and mature your team beyond Salesforce certifications? If you wanted to improve as a Salesforce professional and you were going to go ask 10 people, what should I do to get better as a Salesforce professional? What are you thinking they would tell you?
The average response is probably go get more certs, get more certifications.
Right. And maybe like focus your certifications on like new areas like AI specialist, data cloud, you know, maybe field service, maybe get some specializations on the designer side around identity or, right, maybe do some DevOps certs, right? I would agree. I think probably 9 out of 10 people would focus on technical elements. What I read on multiple websites online, et cetera, are all based on what can I do to get better? It's focused on technical capability. Maybe one of those 10 people would highlight what we are trying to focus on here, which is the larger driver, right? So going back to those failure rates of 75%, 95%, when I drove into that notebook LM, what I call my wise uncle. So that's what I call each one of my notebook LM libraries. It's like my wise uncle, because I can go in and I can just ask questions of my wise uncle, and it tells me from the data, this is the answer. So I went in and I said, okay, great. Of all the projects that are listed here, which there are thousands, what's the number one cause of failure? What do you think it was?
Probably not how good you know AI.
Correct.
Probably not Apex coding, flow programmatic knowledge.
No, probably not.
I bet it's an intangible skill, maybe the way you talk to people.
So you probably had some insight into that, because at DevPod, right, we do focus on people first skills. So communication is the number one failure area. You are correct. And communication entails a lot of things, right? So it's not only what you say, it's how you say it, when you say it, when you don't say it, who you say it to, what kind of venue say it within. There's a lot there. How you say it under pressure, how you say it when falsely accused, how you say it when blamed. There's a lot. The key, though, is if the number one and number two and three are also intangibles, if these aspects are so high on the people first side, right? These intangible soft skills, if those are the causes for failure, then we should really be focusing on those dimensions on your partner that you're going to work with. So the question really here is focused on, given that those are the likely expectations that people have, those are the likely ways that they are investing in their team, especially because they're motivated. I mean, every Salesforce partner has what's called a partner value score. They have a potential presence in the what's called the Salesforce Navigator, which is a way for Salesforce AEs to know what products and partners to use in different situations. So Salesforce incentivizes these partners of this many validated projects in these kind of these clouds or these industries or other elements. What they don't have on their partner value score is how many of your team members have successfully achieved a competent communicator designation from Toastmasters. How many of your team has gone through resolution and a disarming training, with the Conflict Resolution Institute, or even something like, how many have taken a soft skills course like People First Method and graduated and have their certificate? None of that is on those evaluations. So they're not incentivized. And often, because they're not incentivized, they're omitted. So the purpose of this question is really to smoke out from the Salesforce partner that you're going to work with. First of all, do you recognize what are the top reasons that projects fail at all? And it might open up a conversation to say, have you had any recent projects fail? And are you willing to be honest with me about that? Because sometimes projects fail. It's an endeavor of mutual risk. The client takes responsibility for some of that. And sometimes you just can't win. There's no way to bring it to a successful close. In many instances, there are ways, especially if you can have skilled people who can navigate things early and cut things off where needed and redirect them and all that. So the goal is there to recognize, do they understand what the leading causes of failure are? And two, what are they doing to potentially mitigate that? Is it even on their horizon to do so?
Yeah, you make a great point there. And in the article, I like the three M's you mentioned, right? So not only should we ask the partners that we're potentially going to join with if they're even aware of these intangible skills, but the three M's of do you have a program to model, measure, and mature, right? So we want to be able to model them in our calls, in internal, external calls, when we're talking with the client themselves, when we're talking with any of our employees, project managers, et cetera. And then can we even measure them? Right. I know it's an intangible skill, but there's still ways to measure these things. And I'd like to hear, John, from you how you recommend maybe a partner, either the Salesforce implementation themselves or how we at DevPod can maybe measure things like this. And the last one is mature. So I'll let you maybe give some strategies for maturing and measuring these intangible skills.
That's a good question. It's interesting if you think about, let's talk about a professional service outside of the Salesforce world. So, like an electrician or a plumber. How is that person going to learn and onboard to their role? Are they just going to go and kind of learn, like, this is how you use a wrench? These are the different kinds of pipes. This is the different kind of pipe materials, right? This is kind of how to deal with different water pressures. And then, like, they're just going to head out and like start fixing stuff? No
No.
way, right? What are they going to do? They're going to go behind They're going to become like a journeyman or an apprentice, or they're going to go behind somebody who's been doing this for a long time, and they're going to watch, like, man, when I get this angle stop and it's like stuck behind the wall like this, here's the way I get my hand back there. Here's the way I get my wrench. Here's, right, I got to remember to turn the water off. Here's where I put my towel to make sure and catch any runoff water. All of this is, it's caught, not taught, right? Like they're watching this. This is the modeling. And the same way inside the Salesforce ecosystem, but let's talk about on the kind of the front end sales staff. If I'm going to hire a salesperson, a BDR, an AE, and I'm going to bring them in, I'm not going to be like, hey, here's a couple sheets on our product. You can see our website. It talks about kind of our value proposition. Just hit it, man. You know, like start making calls. There might be some people who do that, but if you're going to be successful, you're going to sit that person down next to somebody who's a seasoned like rainmaker, and you're gonna be like, hey, just listen to this person. They really know like how to speak to someone, how to draw out the right information, right? How to engage, how to discover. They know how to sell. And when we talk about like in sales, you have something called a playbook. And a playbook is like, these are the sales motions that work for us. It's what we say, when we say it, how we say it, right? It's the way that we frame it. It's the way that we redirect and round out those objections, right? The way we get to budget. That's another example of modeling. So why is it that when we get to consulting and we're going to have somebody who comes in with some certifications, maybe they have some prior experience, maybe they worked with a nonprofit or like built out their own, you know, super badge org or whatever it might be. And we're not going to give that person the same element. We want to make them billable as soon as possible. So we're just going to put them out there and have them start doing work. Even if it's not client facing, the work will be client facing. The work has to roll up and be part of somebody's demo, somebody's story. So I find it interesting. So to answer your question, I think this is severely lacking. And I find it odd because other professional services domains like use it extensively. And I think it should be used extensively in professional services. So what I'd recommend is, first of all, on the modeling front, that you create vehicles that people can shadow. So you basically make it part of their onboarding program is that they shadow key elements. They shadow some sales calls. They shadow some demos. They shadow some solution design calls. They shadow some UAT kind of prep. You know, just think about the things that you do that are really relevant and create vehicles that people are already going to collaborate together, which is another element that not enough, in my opinion, not enough SIs take advantage of. They let people work independently a lot. The satisfaction level and the amount of insight and kind of exponentially better product you get when you get two people who get to work together, they get to know each other, they get to start like getting that emotional connection that means like, I'm gonna go the extra mile for you, man. If you ever need anything, like I got your back. The customer benefits from that kind of like alliance and commitment. So create vehicles for them to shadow so that the people who are modeling this can actually watch it. And some of those you can record and be like, hey, look, if we weren't able to get into shadowing a UAT call, just watch this one because that's better than telling them about it or writing something about it. I think the other one, so that's kind of the modeling. That's what I would create is it's just a simple venue that shadowing it is an expectation. And as they continue to mature, they're just shadowing different things. So in the beginning, they're shadowing those kind of critical elements they're going to focus on their current role. But as they move up, right, as they move up to being like a business analyst, as an architect or a developer, there's going to be other aspects to shadow. And so I would make sure shadowing is part of the regular routine. And it doesn't mean that they can't contribute. They're shadowing and they might have something to share and they might have some insight to give, which makes them kind of grow in their, you know, rapport and such throughout the
Exactly.
organization. So there was mature, or excuse me, there was model, then there was measure. And so I think measuring is important and it is sometimes, right? It's easier to measure that someone, you know, passed their exam, right? Their cert exam. I think so when there's programs like People First Method or, you know, there may be others, they're going to have a certificate for that. But I think you can measure it even better in the same way that, you know, let's take a cue from the sales team. So sales teams, they're measuring someone's effectiveness related to the playbook all the time. So they're thinking like, how much conversation did you have versus the customer? There's all kinds of tools related to this. I think we can look at how many accounts get escalated, where you know you're working with the company and like I get an email sent to the engagement manager or to the executive who sold the deal saying like you know things are not going well, I'm not really able to stay in touch or things aren't turning around or whatever it might be. I'd say you can measure escalations. You can measure red accounts, right? When those escalations turn into things that now there needs to be like a negotiation, right? You can measure non-bill hours or credits given back to customers, because that's certainly a sign of how effective people are being. I think you can also measure, in the same way you can measure stages in sales and say, like, how long does it take between when we give someone a demo to when, like, we get them a quote, and then from the time they get the quote to the time they either sign or decline. I think you can do the same thing by looking at your methodology and your approach and saying, oh, okay, great. Like, whenever I provide UAT test plans, as we certainly recommend, how long does it take for the client to actually jump in and do those? Because the faster that happens, that means that somebody prepared them well, they prepared the test plan well, and therefore the turnaround time is very fast and it's actionable and the value received is high. If it doesn't move along and it stalls, that means something happened there. I either didn't prepare, I didn't do the test plan well, whatever it might be. So I think there's a lot of little elements like that that you can track. And sometimes, right, project management tools can help with that. There's lots of different ways to do that. But I think really what we're tracking is that these intangibles should result in expedited and somewhat predictable outcomes. And so you can track those outcomes. And whenever they're outside the norm, it's something that you can pay attention to and maybe flag. This could very much be sent to the product owner to kind of just manage these three things or whatever it might be to see how people are doing. I think another aspect, which is super solid, is we certainly recommend recording calls.
That's
And
good.
I think that doing a couple, having people who participate in these calls have a very simple, incentivized way to recognize somebody doing something right. I think it's a great thing. And people many times talk about, catching people doing things wrong. That's how most systems are put in place, right? Their hand gets slapped when they do something wrong. I think thinking about how do we recognize and catch someone doing something right is a great way to build a culture. And I think in this way, it's a great way to motivate this kind of behavior. So when someone has a standout, they're in a meeting, an executive who's not involved, but is just frustrated because of the expense or because of the sales last quarter, they come in and they start to drill and grind and complain. And you see how that person takes that, turns it around, doesn't lash out. And that person gets recognized somewhere because of that. And in fact, the recording from that can be kind of cut out and shown as an example of this is what we do. When we do it right, this is what we do. And it becomes like a banner of recognition. Like everybody should be imitating this. We never want this to happen, but when it does, this is the way to handle it.
And guess what? It's free. You can click record on your Zoom recording.
Yes, it's
You
free.
That's
It's
right. A lot
true.
of the times, the slap on the wrist, you got to pay someone to implement maybe a validation rule. You got to pay someone to implement the report that shows all the missed calls, all the missed texts. But
Right.
no, this time you record the calls, you set something up that has a wall of fame. And maybe if you did want to pay something, you could pay a $5 gift card, Starbucks gift card. Oh, I really appreciate what you've done. We're going to show
Yep.
our gratitude not only by talking good about you to all the people higher up, but also here's a token of our appreciation in monetary form. Like here's.
Right. It's true, and most people like they like the recognition more than they like the money.
That's a good
But
point.
both are nice. So I agree.
Yes.
So that's essentially, I think, we talked about the modeling, the measuring, and when I talk about maturing, it's essentially understanding that it's all a spectrum. That when we deal with human engagement, in the beginning, I might be dealing with a certain type of role, a certain type of stakeholder, right? So if I'm just in the beginning of my business analyst role, I'm usually dealing with maybe frontline staff. I may be dealing with mostly my team, but as I grow in maturity, I start to move up, and I'm now meeting with like executives and the stakeholders. I might even be meeting with our principal stakeholder, and eventually, as you continue to mature, like you're just getting better and better because there's so many different types of people. And nowadays you have so many leaders who, when they were kids, they might have just like played video games a lot. They might have been raised on television. They weren't out on the baseball diamond and doing all of the negotiation and such that happens when you're trying to like align on the rules, and the rules weren't agreed to prior. And so now there are people trying to like work the rules in the middle of the game so they can win. Those aspects might seem silly, but they actually are really valuable. And teaching us how to negotiate with each other and how to be agreeable and find situations that are a win-win for everybody so that we can continue the game and we can have fun. There's a lot of people who didn't get that experience and they're having to learn it in the beginning of their work experience. And so that's why emphasizing these tools and this ultimately what this question is about is, as an organization, how are you looking to mature your team in these people-first dimensions beyond certifications? Because if you don't have an explicit program that's like taking effort and driving into the team and providing incentives to do it, it means that essentially like there's just project failures lurking because inevitably these conflicts and friction are going to arise and people are not going to be prepared to deal with it.
Yeah, exactly. And once you get to that point of maturity, it actually cycles back around to model because now the mature one is modeling for those who are starting the process.
Yeah,
And so
that's a
it's
great
this
point.
competitive value-adding process where those who are growing and becoming more developed in their intangible skills can become that apprentice teacher. They're the master now. So now they're the apprentice where to put the towel to catch the water, where to put the bucket, and how to use it.
Yes, exactly. And I think they can still model the same learn-it-all mentality and the fact that they're
Exactly.
still shadowing and they're still continuing to recognize that there's so much to learn. They're modeling that posture and that mindset.
Yes,
That's
you
good.
should
I think I
observe.
love this. I think we could probably continue all day with this. So let's move on to question number two, which is, can you show me artifact examples used within your projects? And the key here is this goes into failure number two. So failure number one is communications. Failure number two was bad project management. And of course, there's a lot of overlap between the two, but a key element of project management that we're trying to uncover in this question is, does the partner do it in an ad hoc way? Do they leave it up to their tech leads or to their principal consultants or to their product owners to kind of come up with their own methods? That's actually a very common method I've seen. I've worked with about 15 to 20 different SIs over the years, over the past 23, 24 years. And I find a lot of that there's not really a common program or playbook in the business. There's a kind of a siloed, independently run based on the random draw of whatever project manager you might get. And that is, in my opinion, not a good way to do it. What this question is trying to uncover is there a common approach, a method, a methodology that is consistent across your team? Or are you leaving it up to the people you hire to come up with their own method to get it done? Or worse yet, what I've seen is they'll wait for the client to show their level of acumen or detail or demand. They'll do the minimum set that the client requires, not understanding that there are certain requirements in project management in order to be successful. If the partner you're working with doesn't have that baseline set of requirements in order to be successful, your project will be handicapped. And the
Yes.
likelihood of failure goes way up.
Yeah, we call that the deadline document. It's midnight, and oh no, I have to get all the technical things that I was supposed to do, I was supposed to remember for the last 6 months. Let's put it all in one document right now, an hour before the meeting. I guess you wouldn't have a meeting at 1 a.m., but you know what I mean, right? The deadline document is it's coming down to the wire. And like you said, client demand. We don't want an ad hoc. The client asks for something, and on the call, you're flustered and you're saying, oh, yes, I will get that to you. Or let me go and find something, or maybe I have an email or something that I can provide to you. But the ad hoc aspect is not going to give the client what they need. But if you're going throughout the project and you're utilizing artifacts, developing your solution design doc, using your test plans, getting the client involved in the solution design doc and finalizing test plans, not only are they aware and involved in the process of all this technical documentation, but when they ask for it, it's ready and you send it. You say, yes, let me pull it up right now and I can show you. Or give me your email and the email of the other stakeholders and I'll send it to you right now because you've been doing it throughout the course of the project.
It's a great point. I think about anyone who's ever worked with a contractor. Let's say you were working with an electrician and they're working on stuff, and you go in and you ask, and you're like, hey, I know you said you're going to run wires kind of uniquely up this staircase just to make it so that it's not visible. Can you show me what you're going to do? And he's like, oh, yeah, let me draw that up for you right now. And you're like, wait. I thought you already like planned this out. Are you only doing this because I asked you? Shouldn't you be doing this because it's just what you do? That to me makes me nervous. If I work with a contractor and I ask for something that just seems like, of course you should be doing this, right? Like, how do you manage your project otherwise. Like, I still know people who don't use a project management tool when running a Salesforce project. They just try and run the whole thing maybe out of Excel or something, or they just do it over email. That's just crazy to me. But anytime I'm requesting something that I feel like should be a given and already be done or in progress, and they're doing it now because I asked for it, that makes me nervous. And I think I like your example because you're talking about it's going on behind the scenes, not because I'm asking for it as the customer, but because it's just the right thing to do. Like, it's the way to succeed. And I thought what's interesting is in the article, I highlight this Pulse of the Profession report from 2020 that highlights specifically that organizations that undervalue project management, and I think that's key. It's not that they don't have the ability to deliver good project management. It's that they undervalue it. They don't think it's that important. They only do what the client asks. They do the minimum. They phone it in, right? They undervalue it. It says that they have an average of 67 more projects failing outright. So if I'm a customer, if I'm a partner, and I'm looking to use another partner to help me deliver, maybe help me go faster, help me do something more complex, to me, this question is so key because I want to know, do they undervalue project management? Because those 67% of projects that outright fail, I don't want to touch any of those. I don't
Exactly.
want that to be any part of what I'm doing and what my customer is needing.
Yeah, that's a great point. And the value maximization is, you think maybe, oh, I don't want to spend the extra 30 minutes doing this. It's going to charge the client, et cetera. The value that these artifacts are going to provide is going to outlive you, right? They're going to be Google Docs or other methods of storing this data, but it's going to be given to the client. Especially if you're doing maybe using Miro to process, map out your processes, or you're using Excel spreadsheets to show the list of fields and the values that were put in them. That's something that future consultants or a future admin of that client can actually use. And so not only does it maximize the value after you've left, but it mitigates the risk in the moment too. And that's something that I had mentioned at the beginning, the DevPod that we excel in, if I can speak highly of ourselves, is that we like to mitigate risk for clients specifically, or rather with partners for clients specifically, because of the artifacts that we use, that we want to artifactualize and make concrete all of these intangible things. Because these intangible skills don't stay ethereal, they don't stay up there and intangible, they become actual things that that are tangible, right? Like you say, as soft skills and hard money. That our intangible soft skills become hard artifacts, hard money that relate to something in real life that actually make people's lives better.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, they become tangible assets. Love it. So let's talk about question number three
Yeah.
is so it is, can you share different ways you will help maximize my team in this project? And the focus on this is, if you think about any given Salesforce project or technical project in general, ultimately the finish line. What describes the finish line and the future state or the target, however you want to think about it? Who defines that? Well, that's defined by the business, the people in the business. And the people in the business have a tremendous part to play in the process, right? I always use the phrase that this is an endeavor of mutual risk, and we both have a part to play. And if either one of us doesn't play our part, then the project ultimately will be handicapped and potentially fail. Now, the stakeholders will often define what the project finish looks like. But the people who have actually the most insight into getting to that project finish line and often kind of informing ways to make it more valuable, I have found that they are the front line employees. They are the people dealing with customers every day. They're the ones in the warehouse on the phones. They're the ones who are, like facilitating the kind of being the traffic cop of all of the production that goes on. Those are the people who really have the insights into where value can be found in the business, where Salesforce can really make an impact. Now, I'm not sure how many corporate environments you've been a part of, but the ones I've been a part of tend to have political problems and pressures. So one example is, when's the last time you were at a conference room table surrounded by executives and they insisted on having frontline employees, the office manager and the guy who it loads the stuff off the truck and brings it into the warehouse, and the one who takes the measurements from the customer over the phone, or the one who goes to the house and actually measures out. And they insisted that they were at the table so that we could recognize and represent their position and kind of perspective in the business. Man, even saying that sounds so refreshing, but have you ever heard of that happening?
No.
I think I've heard of stories maybe from Elon Musk, right? Like the way he meets with his, like, what's the biggest problem in this company? And he goes and he meets directly with that person. And he says, I'm going to be here and we're going to solve this together until it's done. Or I've heard it from Steve Jobs back in the day, where there would be some kind of a, design challenge or a technical issue, and he'd want to go directly and be with that person. But for the most part, I find that it's very rare that most of the time the perspectives, the opinions, the demands of these frontline personnel are not very respected. They're not solicited. In fact, most of the time they're deferred and even punitively so. Sometimes people are penalized by complaining. They're called complainers, or they're called just they're creating friction, right? Like they should just get to work, just do get the job done. And so what they do is they invent their own ways of getting the job done, right? They invent the little Access database or the little spreadsheet, or they invent their own way to do it. And at the same time, sometimes the IT or other people who are trying to create systems to help them, they're mocked for that because they're like, I created a system for you. Why don't you use it? Why are you using this stupid spreadsheet? So on multiple fronts, they're somewhat demeaned, and they're just trying to ultimately do the job that they were hired to do. And they have to do all this other work before they can actually do so. So think about an environment where that's been happening for 10 years. And now there's three, four, five of those people that need to participate in the project in order to make it successful. Now, that's from my perspective. I don't know that the business thought that way. Like, for example, when I go ask my wise uncle about project failures, I ask about, hey, how often do the actual stakeholders, like the actual end users who will use the product, how often are they omitted from the project that is supposed to be serving them? And it's like a high percentage. I think it's under 50%, but it's more than 5%, which was crazy to me to think that the person that's actually some representative of the person that's going to actually use the software is not even present in the project at all to help us recognize, oh, you don't do it this way? Me, executive, five layers above you who never goes to the warehouse. I have expectations that are different. I have assumptions that are different than what you're describing. Well, I think that should be obvious. So, getting back to the point of this question, if that reality is happening in most businesses that have these political dilemmas, they have this inertia inside where people are actually motivated to not help one another because they don't like each other. They don't want to see people being recognized at the staff meeting. They don't want to see people thrive and get promoted because they just don't have that kind of culture internally. And so now we want them all to participate and be friends in this Salesforce project. We want the stakeholders of the business that we work for to include these people and have it be all harmonious. Oh man, that's going to be tough. So the question here is focusing on back to the intangible skills.
That's
Can
right.
you help me understand how you're going to help all those people get along and actually support each other for the sake of this project? Because if you can't, I need to find someone who can, because without their input, the project is destined to fail. We can't just tell people what they're going to do, because they know what the customer is demanding of them and have been working on their own ways to solve it to their credit for years. And we need to unlock that value to make sure that Salesforce includes those customer expectations that have now become part of their domain. And that's what this focus, that's what this question is focusing on, is what are the things that you're going to do to bring out the best in my people? Because yeah, they might have some political concerns, they might have some anxieties, they might be introverts and not really, they're shy, they don't really like sharing, they just like getting the work done. They don't want to be wrong, they don't want to mislead you, they don't want to like feel like they're claiming to know more than they do, right? There's a host of concerns. So that's what really this is trying to smoke out, is what are the methods that you're going to employ to be able to bring out the best in the people that really have the deep insight in what the customer needs are and what the Salesforce solution needs to include.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a great point. And more than just the project manager needs to have that ability too, because you might be tempted to think, well, they're the one primarily interacting with the stakeholder, or if we are actually listening to what we're talking about here, we brought the end user in, the project manager is typically the one that's interacting with them the most or at all, because maybe you just have implementation or your devs or business analysts below, not really talking to anyone at the stakeholder. Now, hopefully that's not the case. Hopefully your project manager is great with intangible skills and he or she is a great people person. But that also needs to be true of your business analysts, of the technical people that you're working with, because what happens if you're on the late night call working on a deployment with the client and something goes wrong? You want the person with the people skills, not just the project manager, to be able to relate to the stakeholder, because a lot of the axioms that we use and that John's been talking about can be applied to anyone, not just the project managers. So being not getting analysis paralysis or being calm under stressful situations, things like turning chaos into compliments, all of that should be done by people more than just the project manager.
That's a really good point. I mean, in the article, I highlight a PMI research study that calls these things power skills. And the top power skills that they identified were communication, problem solving, collaborative leadership, and strategic thinking, which I think are all really, really great examples. And you're right, every role needs to have that, whether they're customer facing or not, because I need to have this with my own team, right? I need to have this ability to motivate. I mean, essentially, I'm motivating people, and I need to have some level of accountability because I have deliverables I need from people that I actually don't have authority over. Like, I don't have authority over the client, but I need things from them. So I got to use collaborative leadership in order to motivate and incentivize those deliverables that I'm competing against lots of other priorities and pressures in their world. So how to do that is very, it's a very important skill to develop. And I think the same is true because sometimes I'm going to need things from my own team, right? So as a partner, they're going to need to be have an atmosphere inside their own teams that has this level of kind of collaboration, mutual commitment. This is why, like people who use the pod model, it's very good because you have the same group of people working together over and over and over again, building
Exactly.
rapport, and building that kind of emotional commitment. Because if you have the same political dilemmas in your consulting partner, because they're huge and most projects, like most people don't even work together. They have never worked together on a project before, and you throw them in because they kind of form the technology recipe that the client needs. In my opinion, like there's a lot of risk there because if that gets hairy and that project starts to get hot, all of a sudden, like there's no emotional commitment, right? It's like they say, if you're going to go and you're going to climb a 14er, you should never go with people that you don't know. You should always go with people that you know because climbing mountains is hard. And sometimes you get up there and you like start having like altitude sickness and even altitude psychosis, right? People start believing strange things and they start like being motivated to doing crazy things. And you need the people that are committed to you, that know you, and they want to help you and they go out of their way. So this is what you're trying to smoke out at the partner is like, do they have the same problems your customer does? Because you don't want to double the trouble, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And not just are they accidentally absent or don't non they're not even cognizant of whether they have the issue because they don't measure it or they don't spend enough time with their team to recognize it, but do they have a specific program? Do they have a specific process? Do they have incentives in place to kind of create these abilities? for the staff to bring out the best, right? Do you have ways of recognizing success? Do you have, specific phrases that you use, or kind of, brainstorming and artifacts? And, we use, for example, Miro boards that have that come kind of pre-filled sometimes with, decision trees and different things that make it very easy for the client to avoid blank canvas blockers and kind of move in and really be able to participate. Because the faster people get to clarity, the more they can get momentum. And momentum is really what's motivating. It feels so good to get out of a meeting and be like, "Do we accomplish so much in that meeting together? Thank
Yeah,
you for
exactly.
preparing that for us, and thank you for kind of queuing that up and it bringing out the best in us." That's just a beautiful, kind of an up spiral, right? Where it's like now we're growing and people really feel momentum. And now if you contrast this with the change management cycle, right? Anybody who's seen the Valley of Despair, right? So this is why you need all of this, because while all these meetings are happening and you're working through the Salesforce project, like they're descending,
Right.
like into the Valley of Despair. They're just like, "Oh, this is so hard. I didn't realize I had to
Yeah,
commit so much time.
exactly.
Like I'm missing some of my vacation that I wasn't able to take," and all of that's happening at the same time, which is another just, unavoidable
Right.
obstacle. So you definitely want to make sure that any partner you work with or any subcontractor partner that you're going to bring together to help deliver a project has a program that works to bring out the best in the client stakeholders, and especially those often undervalued frontline staff and personnel. Well, this has been an excellent discussion, Jackson. I really appreciate you joining our call today.
Worse.
And for everyone else, please subscribe, share this with a friend, drop a comment below our Salesforce Ben article. And thank you for Ben and team for just agreeing with us that this is a very important topic to share about. We want to move the needle on more Salesforce projects being successful. And especially as we move into a higher level of complexity with AI, with a much wider horizon of project scope as it relates to multi-cloud, and we start to see more and more Salesforce orgs have a lot of history and technical debt that needs to get taken care of at the same time. So have a great day, everyone, and look forward to seeing you soon.
Thanks all.
Thanks for joining us on another episode of Salesforce Trails and Trials. If you found this episode valuable, we would love your help reaching others. Please subscribe, leave us a 5-star review, and share this with another who would benefit.